Submit a proposal for a talk at our new virtual conference, Coding with AI, the End of Software Development as We Know It. Go to the episode notes to find a link so that you can submit your talk. The conference will take place April 24, 2025, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. All right, so today we have Shelby Heinicke, Senior Research Manager at Salesforce. So Shelby, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben. Really excited to be here today.
All right. So I guess we'll start with the hot topic of the year, which happened to be the hot topic of last year, which is agents.
Right? Oh, okay.
So yeah. I have a few topics around agents that I wanted to discuss with you. The first one is, it seems like one emerging trend, Shelby, is that these agents are now increasingly capable of doing GUI-based interactions. Is this my imagination, or are the foundation models, have they made recent progress to allow this to happen?
Yeah, I think the research community has made tremendous progress to allow to make this happen. I think there's a couple of core pieces of technology there. I think on one hand, we've made tremendous progress on what we call function calling. So as you can imagine, say a user wants to accomplish something, whether it's in a GUI or whether it's not in a GUI, maybe just behind the scenes, they want to accomplish sending an email, they want to accomplish completing a task. We have made so much progress in training our LLMs to call the correct functions, to write the correct API calls, to call the correct apps to do that well. So that's a key piece of technology. We saw lots of progress last year. And let's give you an example of something my team has, we've spent a tremendous part of our year on. We built these, what we call large action models, and they do exactly that. They focus on, given a task, given the context, write the plan, write the exact API calls and the function calls to execute that. So in order to, again, going back to your example on navigating GUIs, this is definitely one technical piece there that, given what the user wants, which functions need to be called to get there. Now, that's one key piece of technology that's enabled that. Now, a second piece, there's a different approach here. Now, for some, sometimes you want to call functions behind the scenes. Now, sometimes you don't know those functions a priori. So it might be helpful to learn from what you see to give this agent ability to reason about images, to reason about video. We're making a lot of progress there. So we've seen progress there last year. And something that we just released only a few weeks ago, this is one of my first times even talking about this work, is we released, I told you about our large action models, we released multimodal action models. Now it's these models that take in image and text and produce API calls and produce the right function calls. And again, that makes navigating GUIs a reality as well.
And what makes this powerful is that the reality is a lot of knowledge work still relies on these GUI-based interactions. Most knowledge workers are not programmers or coders. So they do interact with the screen, and progress in multimodal models, visual language models, are very helpful in this regard. So to the skeptics out there, Shelby, right? So what says you when they say, isn't this just robotic process automation rebranded?
Oh, yeah. We've been automating forever. Automation is not a new concept for any of us, right? I think what's really special is that this automation is driven by LLMs. And LLMs, we've shown over the past years, are just particularly powerful. The concept's not new, but I think what we're going to be able to achieve, we're going to see exponential automation, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then I think also the earlier generation of robotic process automation was very kind of, tightly scripted. Right.
Yep.
So, in this case, as you alluded to, the idea here is if you get to these multimodal models that can see the screen,
at
some point at the pixel level, then they can really kind of understand what's happening in the screen. And now, of course, I guess the other helpful thing here, Shelby, is the fact that now we're beginning to see kind of much more of these reasoning enhanced models that can reason, right? So that can think and reason.
Absolutely.
Which of course, comes with its downsides because the inference cost is much higher, right? So in
exactly.
fact, I would say one of the buzzwords this year would be inference scaling, right? So
it's inference scaling, yes. I think we're going to see a lot more of reasoning this year as well, too.
Yeah. And reasoning by nature means a lot of compute is going to get pushed over to inference, which will make inference a lot more potentially expensive, and a lot more work will need to be done to make that efficient. So
absolutely.
I would say the combination of multimodality and reasoning enhanced models will make agents even more powerful this year, right?
Definitely. And to your point about, you know, saving on compute, I think one thing I'm very interested in and keeping an eye on is how much reasoning can we pack into a smaller package, right? To a smaller model. So it will be interesting to see. I think just this week, the news this week with DeepSeek, they got their reasoning model fantastic. And they also have their distilled version. So tiny version. So haven't had a chance to play with it directly myself, but I'm very hopeful that, even in a small package, we're going to see really impressive reasoning.
So my hands-on experience so far with DeepSeek, and which I really like, actually, the V3, the R1, I think if you ask it really on the benchmarks and the leaderboards like Chatbot Arena, it ranks really well, but I find that if you really ask it complicated things, it's still not there with Gemini 2.0 Flash or OpenAI.
Interesting.
But if it's a simple thing, I think it's right there and might even be better because it's faster and cheaper, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think I think that's where we are, especially with smaller models. I think smaller models, every month, like the capacity, what we can achieve has been pushed. But I agree with your assessment that, smaller models, right now may not, especially when it comes to reasoning or multi-step reasoning, may not compare to large models. So, but I'm very hopeful. I think we can really push the boundaries there. So let's see. Let's really see how far we can push these small models.
Shelby, so in your mind, what's missing from the agent stack? The typical agent stack, the way people think of it, right? So you've got the model, right? So you have some notion of memory. You have tools and libraries that the agent can call.
Mm-hmm.
Some people use agent frameworks, right? So
yeah.
And obviously, this is a piece of software. You need monitoring and observability. And you need to work on hosting and serving and all. I mean, it's machine learning at some level. But I think in my mind, one of the things that makes this a little more challenging right now, obviously everything depends on the model's capabilities.
Of course.
Secondly, there's a lot of fragmentation because in my best guesstimate is there's 400 startups and vendors building agent tools.
So many.
No one is using, and the vocabulary is still a bit unclear how people talk about it, right? So they might be referring to the same thing. So I think there's a lot of reinventing the wheel right now. So when you build agents right now, where do the agents usually fall short? I guess let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think, this is such an active area of research. There's a lot we could talk about here. I mean, we could just focus even on the model side.
Yeah.
I think, for example, there's a lot of room for improvement for even function calling and multi-step function calling. So, for example, if you follow the Berkeley function calling leaderboard, this is like one of the widely acknowledged leaderboards for function calling. Earlier in the year, it was focusing on single-step function calls. But now they've expanded their evaluation to be multi-step and to have even more complex cases. And that, again, that basically gives us new problems or, expands our horizons. And of course, models that were good at one, that may have been good in one step, maybe fall short in those multiple steps. So I think enabling, continuing to push the boundaries on what's possible for multi-step function calling is definitely something the community should continue to push forward. I also think going back to what we mentioned earlier about the smaller models, I think especially as we think about making, you know, deploying these AI agents, I think we need to, we're going to want to start thinking about that. And especially as we think about deploying agents that are solving complex tasks that take multiple steps, because smaller models, of course, you're going to, you know, multiple steps, we're going to need to care about efficiency a lot more, cost to serve a lot more. But latency, that's the other thing, latency. We talked about that, that with, you know, with more, with increased reasoning abilities, potentially latency increases. But so with smaller models, if you've got a 10-step process, you want each of those steps to go pretty quickly so that the customer or anyone, the end user, isn't waiting forever. I think we're going to see more of that this year. I know last year we saw a lot of, you know, small language models. We saw a lot of agents. I think this year we'll see them come together, especially as we're in this age of actually deploying AI agents together.
So you're probably like the rest of us, right? So when a new model gets released, you read the release notes. Usually they brag about some benchmark, which is great.
Yes,
right?
So, yes.
At some point, they start appearing in the leaderboard, which is great. But at the end of the day, this is an empirical discipline, and you need to come up with your own benchmarks, your own eval tools. So what are you folks doing in terms of benchmarks and eval and building this tooling out to get you to the point where you're comfortable deploying these agents to production?
This is the most critical part, I think, of the applied research, right? This is the most critical piece. Actually, to your point, you know, these models have great metrics on, you know, math problems, on history, QA, all these, and that's fantastic. And it does tell us about some base level ability. But when it comes down to it, you're deploying these models for a purpose, for a specific end user, specific use case. So you still need a data set, you still need this evaluation set on that use case or on this domain. So two things that I'd like to mention there, you know, as we work with a variety of products at Salesforce, for example, we develop, you know, evaluation sets. We co-create it with our product partners. That's how we can kind of include the voice of the customer and what the end user will expect. And that's how we can include what the purpose is. So I think critically at the beginning of projects, actually, work together to co-create what the evaluation set should be. So I think that that's one thing. And now more broadly at Salesforce, we've actually released what we call the CRM benchmark, and it's completely open. You can check it out. And in a similar light, what we've done is we've created these CRM style data sets, and with CRM type tasks. And what you can see on that leaderboard is all the open source models. We update it constantly with the newest ones. You can even see the small models, and you can see how they perform on metrics on these tasks that reflect what's needed for a CRM. Yeah.
And how big do these data sets have to be? Typically, Shelby, I guess there's no hard, fast rule. Like I said, it's an empirical discipline. So how do you guys put this together? How do you guys put together a reasonable data set for eval?
That's a really great question. I think there are a number of ways to do this. I'll speak generally, like general ways to approach this. You know, one way that you'll see in the industry, you'll see this even in research, actually, is synthetically generating an evaluation set. So potentially using another LLM to help you generate what the data could look like. And of course, here's the thing, if we go back even to ML days, or go back to any time we're releasing a feature, you may never get every single possible variation of what the data could look like, but you could try your best, right? So you try your best to capture all the variants, to capture all the perturbations that you think will appear in the data. So potentially another LLM can help you do that. That's one way. Then of course there's the annotator route, right? Like you can pay experts, or you can pay human annotators to help you craft like these sets. And I think what's important in all of this, again, I think the key is co-creation here, that it's basically interdisciplinary science at this point. When you're talking about deploying a model for users, it really needs to be co-created by model builders as well as the domain and product experts. Yeah.
So do you think transparency and explainability is important for these agents?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I mean, we knew it was important back in the ML days, especially for LLMs, you know, that can generate, you know, anything really. I mean, depending on, you know, the parameters, it's, you know, it's probabilistic, and especially for agents, actually. So, you know, an LLM is a, generates typically, when we think of a typical LLM, you know, it's generating in a single step, like write an email, generates the email, you know, edit this and edits it. But the agent now is multiple steps compounding, right? So it's incredibly important to know what's going on, to have some sense of what's going on so that errors can be caught by, you know, by humans, potentially another agent, whichever way, but there needs to be some sort of explainability, some sort of logging along the way so that issues can be stopped early.
Let's go back to the question of small models, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the way I think of small models is the following. I don't know if you agree with this, right? So the first thing I do is I look at what I can do with a large model. And that becomes kind of the, okay, if I can't do it with a large model, I'm not going to be able to do it with a small model, right? So it's the ceiling for me is the large model. So if I can't do it with, I don't know, some fancy model from OpenAI or Gemini or some large model like Llama, then maybe I should taper my expectations, unless I have such a great fine-tuning data set that I can hope to squeeze something out of a small model.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the keys here, that for sure we've seen that small models can beat big models. You look at, for example, Phi 3.5, it's a great, right? That's Microsoft's great foundation model. They're, you know, approximately 4B, maybe a little less foundation model. I mean, we'd even shown with a 1B model. So we've trained a 1B a 1B function calling model. And we've shown that it's beaten models way like 10, 20 times its size in function calling. I think the key for small language models, it's just really about the scope. They just have a much smaller scope, but with the right training set, you know, as long as the quality is there, that's the other key, that these small models tend to be sensitive to, all models are sensitive to data quality, but the small models in particular. So as long as the data quality is there, they have incredible potential. And I'm interested to see this year how far we can push that.
Yeah, I think one of the key lessons from DeepSeek and a few other companies is it seems like reinforcement learning is becoming relevant again in the following sense, right? So before, when you had to do reasoning, you had to do supervised fine tuning, right? So you had to hand label a lot of these reasoning steps. And they, even if you do it well, they're so fragile because, as you said, right? So if it's multi-step reasoning, I mean, how can you possibly label multi-step reasoning well in all sorts of possibilities, right? So it seems like what DeepSeek has done and another company from China, Prime, have done is that they've kind of proven out that, hey, maybe we can get by with some notion of reinforcement learning or reinforcement learning combined with some supervised fine-tuning, which means we need less labeled data sets. And it seems like not that that impacts any of us because we're not going to build these models ourselves, but it makes me hopeful that the reasoning capabilities of this model will improve given that they're going to be less reliant on these labeled examples.
Right, totally. I definitely agree with you that, you know, supervised fine-tuning, you know, to train reasoning has its limits, you know. And I think, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where reinforcement learning can take us.
So another area that you are interested in is on-device AI.
Oh, yes.
So what's the latest and greatest there?
So on-device has been around for a while. This is also not a new topic, right? Like we, you know, there was a tiny ML that, you know, still exists, and we've been getting models on devices for quite a while. I think what's now been enabled by small language models, this is just a consequence of small language models, is now we're thinking about on-device generative AI. Now we're thinking, okay, where does generative AI fit in the landscape? So, I think, you know, we've got 1B models that exist now. There are, even sub 1B models that exist. So for example, Meta has a, you know, it's, I think it's like less than 500 million generative AI model that, and these are all fantastic to, you know, be put on phones. Now, it's now just the models, the models themselves, you know, typically for phones, they need to be I would say 7 billion parameters is the max size we could handle on today's phones. Of course, phones will get better. I think that, you know, as long as if you're dealing with a model 7B or less, there's still work to be done to actually get it on the phone. So we have to, we employ some techniques to do that. So I, one of the biggest things that we do is we quantize the model. So we take the model, we take in with its weights and activations, typically, you know, could be 16-bit or 32-bit floating points, depending on the model. We want to reduce each of those weights and activation down to maybe 4-bit, down to maybe 6, 8-bit. We can decide and experiment. And that really reduces the footprint of the models. That allows it to fit on the phones, the disk space, especially if it fits in the RAM. So it makes it the model, you know, much more capable of being deployed on device.
So what sort of examples on the phone do you think are available now that people may not be aware that on their phone are these powerful apps?
Yeah. Okay. Right now, I think I'm actually waiting to. So there could be. I'm sure you know when you use your phone, there's plenty of small machine learning models already on the phone. But in terms of generative AI, I'm curious to see more. Now, I know, for example, we could go back to last year. We know that Apple made their big announcement. They are on their newer phones, right, with better hardware. They are having on-device generative model, right? And I remember, didn't go through the technical document there, but I remember that, you know, they're even going to have these LoRa adapters. So one central model with these LoRa adapters to handle different tasks on your phone. So I think that's pretty cool. I'd like to see, I haven't had experienced that myself with it being so new, but I am curious, you know, if we'll see more of that this year.
Actually, for developers who are listening out there, so there's on device AI, there's a couple of interesting dimensions here. One is hardware. Hardware continues, yeah, obviously, to get better. Apple Silicon and others. But the frameworks are also increasingly targeting the phone. So for example, Apple has a framework called MLX, which not a lot of people know about, but it's kind of the cheap way to describe it. It's like Apple's version of CUDA for the phone, right? So you can address it using PyTorch and things you already like. So there's in any kind of new area where AI is going to show up, always look for two dimensions, hardware and software.
Yeah, actually, to add to that, I wanted to add a couple things to that. So one framework that has gotten a lot of attention in the developer community, wildly popular, is Llama CPP. So Llama CPP, super popular, you know, for deploying on laptops, you know, local devices. But you can easily build like a mobile app to actually deploy it, at least on iOS. Maybe they have more Android compatibility. So definitely take a look at Llama CPP. We have built, we've actually open sourced a app that allows you to easily evaluate your small language models on an iOS. So this is definitely doable. So Llama CPP is a great source. And another framework that's out there is, of course, Google's MediaPipe. I think it's been around for a while, but you know, they're really, now they've got, even this, again, this generative AI support going on.
So we talked about multimodal models, but in the context of agents and GUI interactions. So are you paying attention, Shelby, to models that address audio or video?
There's definitely, personally, you know, my team hasn't been thinking about those modalities. Definitely in the research community, there is work in that direction. So I'll be looking out for that. But personally, it's not something my team has been focusing on yet. Yeah. I think breakthrough, you know, as I mentioned, the breakthrough, even just with vision, you know, vision language. Like I said, we just released some work 3 weeks ago with multimodal action models. So yeah, maybe we'll get into other modalities, but for now, that's where we are.
So in closing, right? So if you look at surveys right now, I think probably half or less than half of AI teams actually have agents out there in production. So where do you think this, where do you think this number will be at the end of 2025?
Yeah, I'm pretty. You said what's the percentage?
50%? I think it's about half or less than half, depending on the survey, right? So my guess is given the number of people building tools,
yeah,
I think this number will be higher. But obviously the challenge here is that you have to not hype up this technology, because if you oversell, then people use it, and then that may cause them to kind of pull back on adoption if it doesn't deliver, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We'll just have to see how it goes. I also, we have some agents deployed, right? Like at Salesforce, we have Agentforce that we deployed this year. So I think other companies are also deploying theirs. We'll see how users are actually using these agents. And more importantly, really excited to see the acceleration and the impact, right? To measure that, like how much is this acceleration helping customers and helping users? I think with that information, I hope that it inspires other people to deploy their agents and get it going.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the more people like you talk about some of these success stories, the more people realize that they're actually using agents already without knowing it, right? I think the challenge is that there are some people who hype it up so much that maybe users believe that they're not using agents yet, right?
Interesting. That's an interesting point. I'm sure there's plenty of like apps already that are having some automation, but customers don't know exactly that architecture is an agent behind the scene. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, and with that, thank you, Shelby.
Thank you. Take care.